My name is Jim Nichterlein, and over the next couple weeks I'm going to be here talking on the general topic of Christians and politics. Today, the particular presentation I want to give today, though it won't just be me, I certainly hope to leave time for you to participate. The title is A Lutheran Approach to Politics. Now, the first thing I want to emphasize is my title. That is, it is A Lutheran Approach to Politics. It is not the Lutheran Approach to Politics. There's an important distinction. The approach I'm going to give is based on what's called the doctrine of the two kingdoms. Now, I think it is safe to say that the doctrine of the two kingdoms is the oldest, the most traditional, the most distinctive Lutheran approach to politics. It comes from Luther himself. I think it's reflected in the confessions, the Lutheran confessions, and the way they talk about politics when they do. But even though it is, I think, the most distinctive Lutheran approach to politics, two kingdoms thought is by no means followed by all modern Lutherans. Many are ignorant of it, they don't know what it is, and many others who do know what it is very explicitly reject it. And they reject it for reasons that I'll be talking about a little bit later. The doctrine of the two kingdoms, in fact, has become highly controversial in recent years. Now, I personally think, I'll say up front, I think the doctrine of the two kingdoms is still a valid and useful and positive way for Lutheran Christians to approach politics. And I'll try to explain why I think that way after I've noted some of the criticisms, and some valid criticisms, that have been raised against two kingdoms thought, especially in recent years. It seems to me, first of all, we shouldn't be surprised that there are disagreements about two kingdoms thought. After all, we've had now centuries of Christian reflection about politics. And we've had, over those centuries, an almost infinite variety of ways, different ways, in which Christians have approached politics, thought about politics, talked about politics, acted in politics. At the one extreme, I suppose you could say, you get various visions of Christianizing the social order. The idea of Christendom in the Middle Ages, or we think of Calvin's experiment in Geneva, or in more modern times, we have various visions of Christianizing the social order. You get one version of it on the contemporary political and evangelical right, talks about a Christian America is what we need, the very conservative new Christian right form of Christianizing the social order. And politically, very opposite from that, but in a sense theologically similar, you get ideas from the left politically of the social gospel or of liberation theology that in different ways also want to Christianize the social order. Now, they have very different ways of picturing what a Christianized social order would look like, but these very differing groups politically share that theological common ground in a certain way. That's one extreme, the idea of Christianizing the social order. The other extreme, of course, that many Christians have followed through the years, quite different tradition of Christian withdrawal from politics altogether. That finally Christians and the Christian faith have really nothing to do with politics, and for one reason or another, should keep themselves separate from it. And between these extremes of total separation from politics and Christianizing, transforming the social order to make it a Christian order, you get everything possible in between. So there's been an infinite variety of ways for Christians to do politics over the years. And that's really, as I say, that's not surprising. It's no more surprising than the fact that we have differing varieties of Christian lifestyle, Christian piety, different ways of living the Christian life. I mean, for example, again, at one extreme, there is the monastic ideal, which I think is a very beautiful way to live one's life, to live one's life in total, perpetual worship and adoration of God. and for that to be quite literally all of one's life in a monastic setting. Now that is not a way of life that most of us chosen, obviously. Most of us do choose, but most of us choose more to live in some way in the world. But the point I'm trying to make is simply a very simple one, that there are a lot of legitimate Christian lifestyles, and there's a great variety of them. And so, naturally, the same thing, I think, applies to politics. I don't think there's any one right way to be a Christian in the world. I don't think there's any one right way for Christians to approach politics. I simply want to talk about this Lutheran tradition of the two kingdoms and try to explicate it and explain it. The hope is that all these presentations we have and chances for discussion will be self-contained. But there's a certain logic to the presentations I'm going to be giving over the next few weeks. Begin today really with kind of theological foundations. That is, why the two kingdoms, what its theological origins are. And then developing from there to general ethical principles that follow from these theological foundations. I'll be talking tomorrow about the church and politics, and then in the next couple days after that, individual Christians and politics and dilemmas of political choice and political morality. And then beginning Friday, for those of you who are still here, getting around to talking about specific political issues. In that case, Friday I'll be talking about foreign policy, hawks, doves, and Christians. But a lot of what I'll be saying in the next 2 weeks, the next week and then the week after that, really presupposes the two kingdoms thought that I want to talk about today. Now, and by the way, please, if at any point anything I say is not clear or seems obscure, please interrupt, raise questions. I will try to leave time at the end for general discussion in any case, but short of that, please feel free to break in at any point. Begin by saying that two kingdoms thought, even though it's thought of as distinctively Lutheran, did not originate with Luther. It in fact has a much older basis in the Christian tradition. The idea of two kingdoms really begin with great church father of the 4th and 5th century, probably the greatest of the ancient church fathers, St. Augustine. And it's most fully developed in his monumental theological work, The City of God, which is one of those books that everyone should have read and virtually no one has ever read all the way through. It's very heavy going. I'm one of those few people who can probably say I have read it, but it was only out of sheer coercion. I took a course in undergraduate and I had to read it. I now advise my students to read it in excerpts and brief passages. But anyway, one gets the origins of two kingdoms thought in Augustine and in particularly his City of God. By the way, Augustine lived, he was born in the year 354 and died in 430. It's important, first of all, to note that Augustine, like Luther after him, was not primarily a political philosopher. I mean, Augustine and Luther are theologians. And the political philosophy for both of them is secondary. It derives from, in certain ways, their theological thought. Augustine was a theologian who believed that the chief end of man is to know God and to enjoy him forever. And so for him, politics is a subsidiary and finally secondary enterprise. And derives, as I say, from what is most important in his thought, which is his theology. Now, Augustine's political theory is built on a theory of human nature. The wisest teacher I ever had, David Potter, a great American historian, said that all serious political thought begins with theories of human nature, whether explicit or implicit, and I think he was right. Now, the key element in Augustine's theory of human nature is the doctrine of original sin. And to explain original sin, to explain sin, Augustine goes back to the creation of the human race, the story of Adam and Eve, and the Garden of Eden, with which we're all familiar from our Sunday school, if no place else. Now, for Augustine, the Garden of Eden is a place of innocence, but not yet a place of perfection. It's a place of preparation for perfection. That is to say, God created Adam and Eve good, but he also created them free. And to become truly virtuous, Adam and Eve had to exercise their free will. That is, they had to choose, to become virtuous, they had to choose the good in a time of temptation. So there's a distinction between the condition of innocence and the condition of virtue. An obvious analogy for us today, you can think of a child, an infant. Infants, we can say, are innocent. We don't say they're virtuous because they have made no moral choices. Only a person who can make moral choices is truly virtuous. And in a sense, Augustine's view of Adam and Eve is rather as moral infants. That is, they are people who are innocent, but who have not yet exercised their free will to become truly virtuous. To become virtuous, finally, they have to exercise Christian freedom. And of course, freedom for the Christian is not freedom simply to do whatever one wants. Freedom of the Christian is the freedom to respond willingly to God's will and commands for us. But of course, in the story of the garden, we get not the choice of Christian freedom by Adam and Eve, but we get rather the fall into sin. That is, they use their free will not to follow the commands of God, but to follow their own fancies. In fact, they want to become like God. The serpent tempts Eve and says, take the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the one thing forbidden to them in the garden, and you will become like gods. It's, in this sense, telling the story is the attempt of humankind to replace God, to do without God, to supplant God, in effect. The great sin of human pride. And so free will is used by Adam and Eve not to follow God's will, but to become rebels against God. All right. This is a story we've all heard, as I say, in Sunday school. Now, Augustine says, then, this condition of sin is inherited by all of us. We are born into it. That is our condition. We are by nature sinners. As the old prayer goes, we are by nature sinful and unclean. And the small s sins we commit are a manifestation of that capital S sin, our condition. This is what we are. We commit sins because we are capital S sinners. We are creatures of our own appetites. Now, of course, then, in the Christian story, this sin is followed by punishment, the punishment of death. Death in this mortal life, and finally eternal death, that is eternal separation from God. Now, of course, though, in the Christian story, that is not the end of the story, because this punishment is overcome through the atonement of Christ, sending by God of his Son as Savior. And so then we believe as Christians that we are saved. Saved through the grace of God, freed from the punishment that is rightfully ours. We are made righteous. We become new Adams, new Eves. But there still remains in us, in Augustine's picture of this, the taint of the old Adam and the old Eve. The new Adam, the new Eve have been created. That finally is the final word God gives to us, but there remains in us, so long as we are in this mortal coil, we are still tainted by original sin. We are still old Adam's old Eve's. Now, what follows from this, as Augustine tells the story, is the division of mankind, humankind, into two cities, the earthly city and the heavenly city, which are partially but not wholly embodied in the institutions of church and state. What's really in the division between the earthly city and the heavenly city, what's really central is two ways of life, love of God, love of self. There are two kinds of people in the world, Augustine would say, those who live according to God or those who live according to man. They have different origins, they have different destinations, heaven and hell, which is worked out through predestination. Now, the heavenly city and the earthly city are cities only for Augustine in an allegorical sense. He often, in the City of God, uses the biblical images for these two cities. The city of earth, the evil city, the city of lust and corruption of our own will, that is Babylon, using the biblical image. Whereas the city of God, the city of love, the city of cooperation, of mutuality, of grace, that is Jerusalem. And he often uses these, but he uses these in allegorical, symbolic ways. For the Christian, in fact, Augustine says, there is no earthly city. The immediate founders of the two cities, after Adam and Eve, they have the children, Cain and Abel. And Cain, the evil son, rises up and slays his brother Abel. Cain, then, for Augustine, is the originator of the earthly city, Abel of the heavenly city. But then Augustine goes on to note, he says, on this earth, he says, Cain built a city, but Abel did not. Christians have no earthly city. He says, on earth we have no abiding city. Our goal, as Christians, Augustine says, our city is finally the city of the elect, which will only finally be realized in the communion of saints and in the life to come. Now, in history, short of the second coming, short of that final eternal city in which we shall dwell, and the great separation of the city of earth shall go into everlasting punishment, short of that second coming, the two cities are intermingled in history. We do not know, looking at each other, Augustine says, which of us are in which city. That is really only in God's knowledge, and we shall only finally know at the end. In history, the two cities are commingled, and they will be until the second coming. Now, in the earthly city, there remains, and this is what's central to the politics of Augustine, the persistence of sin. There's always the struggle for good and evil that exists not just between the two cities, the earthly city and the heavenly city, but within all of us. That is, the struggle for good and between good and evil is a struggle even within those of us who are, potentially at least, of the heavenly city. Augustine had very little faith in human righteousness. He says at one point, righteousness is the remission of sin rather than the perfection of virtues. That is, the righteousness we have in theological terms is imputed to us. That is, God chooses to look upon us as righteous. But we are not, in fact, Augustine says, righteous people. Our righteousness is God's righteousness. And the righteousness we have is that of forgiveness of sins rather than the perfection of the virtues. All right, now what does this mean for politics? Well, the earthly city, the city of politics, Augustine says, is always marked by sin. It's always limited and flawed. It's always, in some sense, Babylon. All earthly political systems are, in some sense, Babylon. And yet, for Augustine, the earthly city is not entirely evil. At times, he talks as if there's this total contrast, good and evil. And the state is part of the evil part. The state is part of the earthly city. But at other times, it's almost as if the state becomes a kind of third city. Because when he's talking in the pure sense about the earthly city, Augustine pictures it, as I say, as totally negative. There's no redeeming virtue. And yet sometimes, when he talks about politics and the state, he talks about it as having certain positive values. He says, political society is an assemblage of people held together by common agreement on shared values and interests. And it's a good or bad society, or a better or worse society, depending on the kinds of values and interests we do, in fact, hold in common. The interests we hold in common that make up the basis of our political life, Augustine says, are limited, material, utilitarian. They see to our physical needs as commonly cooperatively agreed on. And yet, even though they're temporal and simply utilitarian and material, the benefits from them are real and are real gifts of God. That's why his picture of the state is not entirely negative. Because at some point he says it is a real gift of God. Because what politics can give us, the greatest benefit it can give us, is the earthly peace. It can give us peace. And that is the great benefit of politics. Order is better than chaos, and a good politics will bring us good order. And this is a high earthly value. The state then, in that sense at least, for all the negative things connected with it, is a positive good. It can allow us to focus our lives then on the love of God and each other. But still, politics has, for Augustine, no transcendent values. No one form of government, Augustine tells us, is preferable to another. There's injustice in all social orders. He advises Christians, in effect, to quietism, to an acquiescence in evil governments. It is better to accept an evil government than to overthrow it, because what we get, chances are, given human nature, will be worse than what we overthrew. Better to keep a tyrant who preserves order than to overthrow the tyrant and get chaos. Throughout the City of God, throughout Augustine's writings, there's a sense of Christians in the earthly cities as, well, he uses certain images. We are aliens, we are strangers, we are pilgrims, we are sojourners, we are captives. We are not really part of it. We travel through it. In some sense, we participate in it. But we really live by faith. We're sojourners on earth, but we live by faith, a faith of hope in the heavenly kingdom to come. When he talks about social virtue, again, for Augustine, social virtue is essentially private. It's not political. Augustine says, yes, we should do good, of course. We should be virtuous. But when he talks about virtue, it's virtue in immediate circumstances, the people we live with daily. Virtue begins with our families and works out from there. He says, the good person is the person who does good to everyone he can reach. And so virtue is defined in essentially personal and immediate terms. And again, to emphasize through all this, there is in Augustine this basic pessimism about the human condition and about what, therefore, politics can achieve. Politics for Augustine is finally a matter of limited importance. It is not a condition of virtue. It is not a condition, finally, of happiness. The Christian's gaze is always elsewhere. The Christian finally, even though he may participate in politics, and he explicitly says, yes, we may, the Christian's gaze is always elsewhere. He's always finally other-minded. He's thinking of other things in the ultimate sense. And if we serve in public life, Augustine says, the Christian does it really through duty. It's not so much a positive thing for serving others, it's a matter of duty to one's fellow citizens. All right, this is the Augustinian tradition that Luther, an Augustinian monk, inherited some 1,100 years later. It's interesting to think in these terms that the distance between Augustine and Luther is almost twice as long as the distance between Luther and us. You're going from the 4th and 5th century to the 15th and 16th century. We recently celebrated the 500th anniversary of Luther's birth in 1483. He was some 1,100 years later than Augustine. As I say, Luther inherited this, but he did not take it over holus bolus. He built on it, but he altered it. Altered it, I think, in significant and positive ways. Now, for Luther, the two kingdoms is the natural equivalent, the natural correlative of his theology, which is basically, as all good Lutherans know, a law-gospel theology. And it's this law-gospel tension which is at the center of Luther's theology, I think, that is the source of his two kingdoms thought about politics. In theological terms, of course, for Luther, the theological use of the law, there are three uses of the law, but the important use of the law theologically is the second use of the law as a mirror. The law tells us who we are sinners, and as sinners we are in need, we are deserving of God's eternal punishment and condemnation. That is what the law reveals to us. And by revealing to us what we are, it serves this useful function, this mirror, this is what I am, and it then turns us to the resources of the gospel. That the only way we can be reconciled with God, each other, creation, is through God's totally free gift of grace. The forgiveness of sins in Jesus Christ, which is ours free gift simply by faith. Now, for Luther, law and gospel exist in tension with each other. They are, and this is important for Luther, they are distinguished from each other, but they are not separated. That is, the law without the gospel is, of course, a message of total despair, because all it says is you are a sinner who has fallen short of the requirements of God, you are a sinner whose final end and deserved end is eternal separation from God. So the law by itself is always condemnation and always needs the gospel, which comes back and trumps the law and says, nevertheless, because of God in Christ, you are saved, you are redeemed. And similarly, though in a less obvious sense, the gospel needs the law. That is, if there is no law to tell us what we are, that we are sinners in need of the gospel, then there is no need of the gospel. I mean, it's all very well to say you're redeemed, but what are you redeemed from? If there's nothing to be redeemed from, then there's no need of the gospel. So law and gospel always have to be distinguished for Luther. And of course, the heart of his theology and of his reading of the scripture is the clear distinction between law and gospel. He must never confuse these two categories. But at the same time, while we must distinguish between them, we can't separate them. All right. Now, from that comes the two kingdoms thought of that is the center, I think, of Luther's approach to politics. They are the two kingdoms of God. The kingdom of the left hand is God. He is both God's kingdoms, but God rules in two kingdoms. And he rules in rather separate ways. You have the kingdom of the left hand, the kingdom of the right hand. You have the kingdom of the law, the kingdom of gospel. You have the kingdom of justice, which is the overriding principle in this left hand kingdom. The overriding principle in the right hand kingdom is love. In the left hand kingdom, again, the kingdom of politics, coercion and power exist and are justified because of persisting human sin. Given sin, we need the use of coercion to keep ourselves in line and in order. Here, of course, again, the opposite, the reign of pure grace. And you can continue these, you know, the opposites. But the important shift here between Augustine and Luther is that for Augustine, this kingdom of the left hand is really separated from God. It is the kingdom of the devil. This is the kingdom that Cain is the father of. And it really has nothing to do with God. Now, it is true that sometimes when he talks about the state, you get a kind of third city. But even that third city, while it's not totally evil in Augustine's sense, is really separate from God's kingdom. What Luther does is to say there are two kingdoms, yes, but it is not this radical separation. The two kingdoms, even though they are distinct, they must be kept distinguished one from the other, they are not totally separated. We as Christians live in both of them. We are not bifurcated human beings, but we are people with distinguished qualities, stations, responsibilities, given different situations. This, again, the left hand for Luther is the secular realm. This is the spiritual realm. Luther's a good separation of church and state man. This is the realm of the state. This is the realm of the church. Now again, these are distinct, but they are related. We are interested in justice because of love. Because God loved us, revealed his love, showed his love in the gospel, therefore we work for justice. Even as it's similar to the tension theologically in Luther between law and gospel, the tension between our lives in this left-hand kingdom and the right-hand kingdom. But what's critical for Luther, and critical for Lutheran politics, again, the term he uses to express this tension that we're in, being in both of these kingdoms at the same time, the famous Lutheran phrase, again, the Latin word, Simul,
S-I-M-U-L,
from which we get simultaneous at once. That is, Luther says, we are at once sinners and saints. We are at once people who have been redeemed, who live in the right-hand kingdom, who are creatures of new Adam, new Eve. But at the same time, there is still the taint of sin. We are still marked by the old Adam, the old Eve, and we live in the state of tension in both these worlds. Now, what's critical, as I say, in terms of Luther's political thought, and what makes his thought, I think, particularly controversial, is that he says, finally, the state cannot be run by the gospel. The state is run by the principles of the law, not by the principle of love, but by the principle of justice. There is legitimate coercion, use of power in the left-hand kingdom that is totally foreign to the right-hand kingdom. In our lives as individuals with each other, our personal relationships, our lives as a Christian community, that to the extent possible for Luther, we live here in the right-hand kingdom. But in our lives as citizens, there we live in the left-hand kingdom, not according to love, but according to justice. Luther has this wonderful thing. He says the problem, people who say the Lutherans don't, or the Christians, didn't refer to himself as a Lutheran, people who say the Christians don't need the law, he says they make counsels for perfection. He says it's certainly true. If Christians lived the way they ought to, there would be no need for the state. There would be no need for coercion. If we lived as we ought, our whole life would be in this right-hand kingdom. But the fact is, we do not live as we ought. People do not, including people who call themselves Christians, who are baptized. The fact is, Christians don't live as Christians ought. Therefore, the need for the left-hand kingdom. He says, it's all very well to say in some idealistic sense, this is in Luther's essay on secular authority in 1523, he said, it's all very well to say to the lions and the lambs and the sheep and the goats and all animals, come together into this common place, and I will give you food, and you will live cooperatively and peacefully. And he says, you know, the lions will love that. But the problem is, after all, there won't be very many sheep left. Given human nature, we need coercion. We need justice. We need the law. And this then makes for quite, in Luther's thought, quite significant public-private distinctions in terms of our duties. We have differing ethical imperatives in our private lives, our private relationships, our relationships before God, one set of ethical imperatives that are really in many ways quite different from the ethical imperatives of this left-hand kingdom, the kingdom of justice. Luther, the most famous phrase summing this up, in terms of what kind of rulers do we want, what terms of governor? And he said, it is better to be governed by a smart Turk than by a stupid Christian. That is, the Turk was the enemy of Luther's time. They were worried about the overthrow of Christian Europe by the Muslim Turks. And what Luther is expressing here is that we're not looking for our rulers for Christian virtue so much. We're looking for people who are wise, who know how to exercise power, who are practical. We're looking for good rulers in rather secular terms, and it's better to be ruled by a smart Turk than a stupid Christian. There is no sense for Luther of the Christianizing of the social order. I guess this is most obviously expressed in terms of differing duties for the Christian. We think, and this is the example that's used over and over, the Christian policeman or the Christian magistrate, he does not do his job according to the New Testament ethic. When he's confronted with an offender, he does not turn the other cheek. He does not forgive the offender 70 times 7. He does not say, go and sin no more. Your sins are forgiven. What he does, he throws the criminal in the slammer. And that's his job. And what Luther says, that is right for him to do his job that way, according to the law, not according to love and grace and the gospel. So for Luther, then, the gospel does not have programmatic political content. The gospel is important to us as Christians in our political life as a motivator. What distinguishes us from our other citizens, from our fellow citizens who are not Christians, is not our political program. There we cooperate with all other people of goodwill who want justice. What distinguishes us is our motivation. That is what makes us separate from our fellow citizens. It's not the kind of politics we come up with. We can be liberals, conservatives, radicals. That, you don't define, the gospel doesn't tell us what to do programmatically. There, as to what to do, we require practical wisdom, knowledge, and of course, justice. Now, this does not mean that the fact that the state can't be run by the gospel, according to Luther, that politics somehow has nothing to do with morality. That's what's often mistaken, that that Lutheran thought is somehow amoral. Not true at all. I mean, the requirements of justice are based in morality. But that is, again, for Luther, following the thought of his time, a matter of natural law, the idea that taken over from Aquinas and even earlier, that all people have implanted in their hearts by God the knowledge of the natural law. We know it by, it's accessible to us by reason and by inclination. And it's not peculiar to Christians, the natural requirements of justice. That's open to all people. Now, this then is the basic outline of Two Kingdoms thought in a very simplified way. Now, very briefly, why has it become so controversial? Why is it under so much attack in so many circles, including many Lutheran circles? Well, fundamentally, I think it's simple. The charge against it is that it leads to political conservatism. And there's a good deal of Lutheran history that supports that charge. The charge is that the problem with Two Kingdoms theology is it leads to a kind of quietism, a kind of preoccupation, otherworldly preoccupation that ignores this kingdom of the left hand. Because Lutherans say, finally, the gospel is more important than the law, that faith is more important than works, that theology is more important than ethics, and this is what Lutherans certainly tend to do, plus the fact that Lutherans often make the sharp distinction between the two kingdoms. The charge that's made is that, therefore, Lutheran political thought has a tendency to ignore social injustice, to ignore social duties, because we are so preoccupied as Lutherans with the kingdom of the right hand and the gospel, and we tend then, because we separate the two, rather than simply distinguishing, we often in practice separate, say this has nothing to do with this. And so Lutheranism has tended, so the charge is made, to a kind of conservatism. It accepts the status quo, whatever the status quo is. And of course, the ultimate charge here is Lutheran passivism, not pacifism, but passivism, in the face of Nazi Germany. That a good many Lutherans could go along with Hitler. Some even support him, many even support him, but even those who didn't support him, this is simply another punishment sent by God. It has nothing to do with the gospel. As long as Luther lets me go to church and worship, then the rest finally is no concern to me or minimal concern to me. And it's that, of course, is the most heightened example of the dangers, as they're understood, of Lutheran quietism. The more common one, those of you who come from Missouri Synod backgrounds will be familiar with this. There's the hymn in the old TLH, the last hymn, in fact, was called Heaven is My Home. It expresses this perfectly. I am but a stranger here, heaven is my home, earth is a desert drear, heaven is my home, sadness and sorrow stand round me on every land, heaven is my fatherland, heaven is my home. So however miserable life is, for me or anybody else, well, because of sin, that's what you expect. And you don't expect any more out of politics, you don't expect justice, you don't expect anything good to happen. Earth is a desert drear. And so whate'er my earthly lot, somehow I murmur not. It's wonderful conservative stuff. And when I was a child, it was my favorite hymn. It showed the level of my understanding. I like the melody. And it's that kind of Lutheran piety that I think has quite rightly come under attack. Yet it seems to me Lutheranism does not necessarily have to be conservative. I mean, obviously, empirically, we can point around, there are a lot of people in the world where Lutherans were not conservatives. I mean, you can point to Nazi Germany on the one hand, but there's Scandinavia, which is a totally Lutheran culture, and Scandinavia is not noted for being right-wing politically. So that it doesn't seem to me that Lutherans as Lutherans have to wind up as conservatives. It seems to me a misuse of Two Kingdoms thought that leads to the kind of quietism that will acquiesce in evil and injustice and oppression. After all, yes, it's true, Lutherans do insist on the primacy of the gospel. Finally, that is the thing that is of ultimate importance in our lives. The most important thing about me is that I'm a forgiven sinner. And that is the ultimate thing about my life. And everything else is secondary to that. Everything else is subservient. But that doesn't mean that all those other areas of my life that are of penultimate importance are insignificant. I mean, we love our families, we love our friends, we love our community, we love our work. We don't think those things are insignificant, unimportant, because they're not gospel. We can put a great deal of urgency and commitment into them, and I think we almost all do. And similarly, it seems to me, there's nothing in Lutheran thought to prevent us from giving a true urgency to our sense of social justice and striving for social justice. There's really no way for Christians rightly to ignore or to minimize politics. If we're to take our faith seriously, we have to apply it in a serious way to the things that make a difference to our lives, and politics does make a difference to our lives, inevitably. We remember always properly that the left hand is still God's kingdom. It is not cut off from God's concerns or ours. The variation on the charge of quietism brought against Two Kingdoms thought is that of negativism, similar. In Luther, again, you get very strongly this emphasis on the role of the state being overwhelmingly simply to preserve order in a fallen world. And from this can develop the view of the state simply as a necessary evil, a thing only of coercion, prohibition, restraint, negativism. This is Luther's view of it. You need the state basically to keep people in line. And that really is fundamentally Luther's view of the state. And so it's been charged, and again often rightly against Lutherans, that they fail to see the positive and creative purposes that the state can be put to. Yes, these negative things are there. We do need to preserve order. It's a fundamental purpose of the state. But there's far more involved in politics, particularly in modern politics, than that. Luther often gets a bad press politically because of his actions in the Peasants' Revolt, when he urged the princes to strike down the peasants when they rose up in rebellion. This is not because he was that he thought highly of princes. When he writes of princes, they're all fools and knaves. But the problem is, even though the princes are fools and knaves, the mass of people are unruly and vicious and need to be controlled. And there's a natural hierarchy. God placed the princes in control over us, and our duty as Christians, according to the New Testament, the powers of be are ordained of God, is to obey. The duty of the prince is to rule. The duty of the ruled is to obey. That is the natural order of things. To go against that is really to overthrow God's hierarchy. And that's what Luther saw the Peasants' Revolt as. It's not just that he didn't like their politics. In fact, he urged the princes to make concessions to the peasants. But when the peasants rebelled, they were going against the right natural order of things in Luther's view, and so you get this negative view of the state. Now, I think that the antidote to this negativism in Luther, and is there, can again be found in Luther himself and in specifically his doctrine of vocation. Luther says, and again, he's not unique in this, Calvin very similar in many ways, and the duty of vocation, it is the Christian's duty and his joy, his opportunity, to serve God and neighbor in the place in which God has placed him or her. That as we do our duty in the world, Luther says, you know, you do your duty by doing what God has placed you to do as well and as honestly and as decently as you can. If God has made you a carpenter, be the best carpenter you can be. If you're a shoemaker, repairer, person, that's what you should be. Do you exercise your duty to God in this world through vocation? Now, it seems to me there are really significant implications here for the role of the modern Christian as a democratic citizen. In modern democratic societies, part of our vocation is to be a citizen, to participate in politics. And here Luther's of no use at all, because Luther lives in a pre-democratic world. There are the rulers and there are the ruled. The ruler's duty is to rule, the ruled is to obey. Boom. Well, we, of course, in a democracy, are both the rulers and the ruled. We participate. So that we can use politics, the great mass of us, in a far more activist, fruitful, positive, creative way than Luther could ever have imagined. And for him, the state is a very simple thing and preserves order. Well, that's miles removed from modern conditions, from the welfare state, from participatory politics. So it seems to me that by applying the doctrine of vocation to Two Kingdoms thought and the pursuit of justice, you free Lutheran political thought of any connotations of pure negativism or restriction. And it provides, I think, a theological justification for as much Christian activism as you want. It doesn't prescribe what kind of activist you ought to be, except in certain extreme cases. I'll be getting into that in the days to come. But it certainly does not prevent us from being, in any sense, activists. So I'd say, I suppose, in conclusion, that if Lutherans wind up as political conservatives, well, that's their political choice. It's not their theological fate. There's nothing in being a Lutheran. I was asked a couple of years ago by my friend Richard Neuhaus to write a little piece for his forum letter on must Lutherans be political conservatives, precisely because this charge is so often brought against Lutheranism. And he and I were both trying to strike that down. Well, at this point I've talked a great deal, covered an awful lot. Are there questions, observations? Points of disagreement? Yeah, John.
Yeah, I think it's interesting and important, maybe when you think about, maybe not so much Luther, but Augustine, where Luther gets a lot of his ideas, to remember that Augustine was living and working at the time when, you know, there was chaos in the political state. The Roman Empire was breaking apart, and anarchy was something that Augustine, you know, lived with day in and day out. And it was also something that Luther's theology, you know, he was very much afraid of anarchy. He was less afraid of the opposite thing, which would be tyranny. Tyranny was not something that he was afraid of. It was anarchy. And his theology is kind of geared that way. He's looking one way and not so much the other way.
Yes, what you say about Augustine, very true. I didn't want to go into that, get into too much detail, but you know, in 410, there's the fall of Rome, the sack of Rome by the Goths, and 3 years later, he starts to write The City of God. And the pessimism, the sense, you know, classical civilization has collapsed, the barbarians have taken over, anarchy and chaos are all about us, and no doubt that affects, you know, the way he comes at state. But I think Luther, even though, as I say, he inherits that, has a good theological basis, and that he does, at least, even though he himself didn't follow it out, and that's, in, I think, in good part, simply because he's a creature of his time, there is still, I think, a basis in Luther's Two Kingdoms thought that doesn't at all necessarily have to lead to quietism or to removal from politics. That temptation is always there. It is there, and I think we can't deny it. The great temptation of Lutheran political thought is to quietism, to a sense of, well, finally, politics isn't all that important because the gospel is what really counts. And that temptation is there, but any system of political thought, any system of theological thought has its particular temptations. You know, it takes your choice. Yeah.
A couple things. Woody Allen said, it's not laying down with the lion that's important, it's getting up that matters.
Right.
It seems like the Two Kingdoms theory, which I basically embrace, but how I heard you describing it, might lead us to think that A, politics is important, but B, it doesn't matter what your political viewpoint is. And at some time, don't we have to say, this type of politics is wrong? And, you know, when we're thinking about South Africa today and on everything you quoted, I was just thinking, you know, what difference does it mean? You know, tyranny is better than anarchy, you know? I go, I hope not. Sometimes we have to say no. And I think that comes from gospel as well as justice.
Yes, well, I will be getting into that more in succeeding presentations, because I think that's definitely true. I think there's a great range of legitimate political positions for Christians to take. But Christians can't be anything. We can't be racists. We can't be totalitarians. We can't believe in random torture. Obviously there are limits. And there are significant limits, but I'm not sure your last point that I agree with. I don't think we need the gospel for that. I think all of that is there in justice. All people know, whether they're Christians or not, in the broad outline, what is, at least this is what Luther believed from Aquinas, and I guess I accept it too, that there is a sense of natural law. There are principles of natural justice that are accessible to all people, whatever their theological or non-theological views. That is why we can cooperate with people of all political views, and that's why Christians may often be divided politically. So there are limit situations, there's yes, no, but I'm not sure. Except in terms, again, the gospel is important for us, I would say, as Christians, in terms of motivation. That's what makes me different, or you different, from a fellow citizen who's not a Christian. But I'm not, I'd have to be persuaded, and I know there's a very large Christian tradition to the contrary, that's often been presented here at the Village, the politics of Jesus and so on, that is a quite different view of this, and does think that the gospel has programmatic political implications.
Because what you're saying by that is the gospel is personal salvation, mm-hmm, versus a social salvation. That our call as gospel people, mm-hmm, is to bring about, or to help God bring about the kingdom with everybody, and not just me, myself, and I, personalistic sort of way, which is, I think, what Luther basically did. I think how he laid it out was accurate for Luther.
Well, if you say the state can't be run by the gospel, then you believe that there is, through politics, no bringing of the kingdom, in the ultimate sense. Luther would insist on that, and I think he's right. That is, if you believe, one of the old games, the world is divided into two kinds of people, including the people who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. But in many ways, in this point, one of the fundamental line is those who believe in original sin and its power and those who don't, in a certain sense. I mean, Luther would say, obviously, I think any serious Christian struggles for justice for the relatively better, as Reinhold Niebuhr and others would put it. There are political systems, some that are better than others, but there is no way that any political system can become an equivalent of the gospel kingdom. There finally is a separate realm. Well, back to Augustine's sense, the heavenly city, but it is finally not achievable in the political world. Now, South Africa, I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, what has Two Kingdoms thought got to say about South Africa? Well, I think the realm of justice is enough in itself to tell us that apartheid is wrong and must be fought. I don't need the gospel to tell me that apartheid is wrong. Where Christians then may, and I don't think Christians can legitimately disagree on that issue. I think if you say, I'm a Christian, I believe in apartheid, racial superiority, then to that degree you are not being Christian. But where Christians can legitimately disagree is, what do we do about it? Do we use sanctions? Do we use quiet diplomacy? Do we do a whole range of other things? Do we use the Sullivan principles? There you get legitimate disagreement, because this comes down to reason, prudence, what will work, what won't work. We agree on the end. The end should be the end of apartheid. But I think it's very dangerous for Christians to start talking as if means to those ends are also prescribed by the Christian method. And that, I think, is a temptation of both the Christian right and the Christian left, of saying, not only do I know the ends, but I know the means. Well, that's all right. I mean, after all, we're individuals, and I don't think there's any reason why Christians should not be politically active, shouldn't be ideological. It simply means you have to be very careful about where they can say, thus saith the Lord, in a pretty authoritative way, and when they can say, well, this is an area of legitimate disagreement. And that's about all, I think, that Luther or Lutheran thought would have to say about the thing of apartheid. It's important that it can, I think, very definitely say it is wrong. And then we work from there as to what to do about that. Are there other...
Where does capital punishment
come? Yeah. Well, again, Luther... Luther believed, would have believed that that's just. Capital punishment is allowable. You can use whatever coercion and force is necessary to preserve order in a fallen world, including, if necessary, fatal force, whether it be a soldier or for those who commit capital crime. Capital punishment. I deal with politics all the time. I write about politics all the time. I have a position on most political issues that I'm fairly comfortable with in my own mind. I've worked out. Capital punishment is one I flip back and forth on. And it's one that really does give me tremendous dilemmas as a Christian. Well, I may have a session later in the second week for any of those who happen to be around. In fact, on the question of capital punishment, in which I try to present the arguments for and against it and where the Christian comes down. But I think there are situations outside the tradition. I put it this way. Two kingdoms thought does not lead to pacifism. It is allowable in a just cause, for Luther believed in principles of just war. It is allowable under those situations to engage in battle, which will involve the possibility of killing and being killed. And one argument for that is you could then extend that principle to the domestic situation as well.
So you feel that just wars still exist?
In principle. Yeah, now you get into, again, I want to bring this up when we talk about Christian hawks and doves. There's one thing to say, I think there is such a thing as a just war, yes. I think World War II was a just war. I don't have problems with that. Whether the principles of just war can still apply in a nuclear age, of course, is a very different question, and it does get in fact, the principles of just war, that the very fact of nuclear weapons might mean that there is no such thing as a just nuclear war. I'm inclined to believe that. But war in itself, by two kingdoms thought, is not outlawed. There are such things as just wars. Any other questions? Or well, if not, we're at 11:45, where we should be. For those of you interested, tomorrow I'll be talking about the church and politics. And when I say the church and politics, I mean the church collectively. Because I think there are significant distinctions to be made between individual Christians and their political duties and obligations and possibilities, and that of the church collectively.